Let me read to you a focusing section from Euripides' Bacchae, from the chorus near the end. Hounds of madness, fly to the mountain, fly, where Cadmus's daughters are dancing in ecstasy. Madden them like a frenzied herd stampeding. Against the madman hiding in woman's clothes, to spy on the Maenad's rapture. First his mother shall see him craning his neck, down from a rounded rock or a withered trunk, and shout to the Maenads, who is the man, you Bacchae, who has come to the mountain spying on the swift, wild mountain dances of Cadmus's daughters. Which of you is his mother? No, that lad never lay in a woman's womb. A lioness gave him suck, or a Libyan gorgon. Justice, now be revealed. Now let your sword thrust through and through to sever the throat of the godless, lawless, shameless son of Echion, who sprang from the womb of earth. See with contempt of right, with a reckless rage, to combat your and your mother's mysteries, Bacchus. With manic fury, out he goes, stark mad, for a trial of strength against your invincible arm, the sober and humble heart that accords the gods their due without carp or cavil, and knows that his days are as dust, shall live untouched. I have no wish to grudge the wise their wisdom, but the joys I seek are greater, outshine all others, and lead our life to goodness and loveliness, the joy of the holy heart, that night and day is bent to honor the gods and disown all custom that breaks the bounds of right. And in those famous lines from 2,500 years ago, Euripides sums up the quintessential tension in the whole consciousness transformation. The very bounds of day and night will be bent to fit God's justice. Natural, you say? Cyclic law? It'll shrivel in an instant compared to the supernatural power of divinity. And with that supernatural power of divinity operating in a man, you get the statement like Ahab and Moby Dick, who says, "Man, I'd strike the sun's face if it insulted me." Aside from the poetic language and the frightful imagery, what's at stake here is a transformation of internalizing nature to the point of symbolic focus, so that what comes out after that is no longer subject to nature, no longer subject in the sense to natural law, but now has a different drummer behind it. It has magic and not nature. Magic is the power source and not nature for the transformed consciousness. And it makes a great deal of difference. Now language has a command function. It is able to decree on the basis of a symbolic structure a rearrangement of nature. What came out as lead in nature is transformed to gold by the magical power and the symbolic operative. Now, the danger and the difficulty, of course, is in the initial transformation area, when one is freshly in the supernatural realm, freshly in the magical realm, freshly arrived in consciousness, one still has a great many ties. Most transformations are not very deep, they're not very complete, especially when it comes to the transformation of becoming conscious of oneself without a real, powerful, cultural transformation initiation, or without some teacher who is really capable of doing it right completely, we usually go dribbling into a consciousness rather than having a realization, rather than having a sense of certainty that we're in a different mode. We have all kinds of adolescent probabilities. Well, perhaps today I'm all right, but who knows about tomorrow or tonight? And so maturity, this new conscious maturity, when it first occurs, is very fragile. Fragile in its self-confidence, fragile in its capacity to have faith. And so always surrounding, like a penumbra, always surrounding the fresh transformations are all these protective, amulet-like qualities. The insistence on the acceptance of faith that you have done it, faith that you have arrived somewhere, that this is now efficacious. In the natural situation, man's culture is the crucible out of which he finds his orientation. His sense of personification is a ritual comportment in terms of the cultural ethos. But once that meaning generated from that culture has been interiorized and integrated, it changes. Once that external ethos has been interiorized and brought to a focus within, one then has an inner life which is more powerful than the tribal life. Then the inner weather is what you go by, and you could care whether it's raining or shining. And once that transformation is made, it's no longer the culture, but it's like the inner culture, which becomes important. Instead of anthropological elements, psychological elements begin to be more important. Yes, you can still have your tribe, you can still have your culture, you can still have your anthropological elements, but they are increasingly subsidiary to the inner voice, to the psychological elements, and to that inner quality. Here is a paragraph on interpreting transformations from this wonderful book that's in paperback now from the University of California Press, Transformation, Masks, and Paradox. And I'll leave the cover out so that you can see this for yourself. This is on page 10. The process of personification is, as in any system of classification or mode of thought, affected by culture. the process of personification is affected by culture. Understanding perceptual paradoxes, such as those made possible by masks, is likewise connected with knowing something about the process of personification in its cultural context. The perception of paradox is an essential quality of the mask function, mask making, mask wearing, mask using, mask identifying, the mask function, which is in a cultural context and deals with perceptual paradox. I am of such and such a tribe in such and such a terrain, but when I put on a mask, I become a force, an energy. Like at the beginning of Frank Waters' beautiful Masks, Gods, his study of Navajo ceremonialism. And he says he was there as a boy in one of the Navajo centers late February. There was still a little bit of powdery snow blowing in the waste of the winter wind. And he was sitting on the back of a buckboard, wrapped in a blanket, like several scores of other individuals. And there were people lined around, and it was just a run-down Navajo Indian village around the turn of the century, around 1901 or something. But he says, then they came. They came around the edge of the building. Other members of the tribe, but now in the ceremonial costumes with the masks of the gods on. And they came, and they were no longer men. They were primal energy forces. They were the gods. When they moved as lightning and thunder and wind. They moved as the spirit of corn. They moved as the spirit of the horse. They were gods. There is a perceptual paradox. Yes, you can see that under the ceremonial costumes, behind the masks, are men of the village or women of the village. But not now. Now they are gods. It's a perceptual paradox. So that in ritual comportment, masks involve a perceptual paradox. But in art, masks involve a conceptual paradox. It isn't just perceptual, it's conceptual. The masks that you are making now are radically different from the masks that you made in the ritual segment. Seeing is powerful, but knowing is catastrophically more powerful. Seeing is like lightning, but knowing is like the whole thunderstorm front of 1,000 miles. The power of being able to see is like being able to handle a foil with rapier elegance, but the ability to know is like being able to engineer a war with an entire army. It's a whole different scale of consciousness, introduces a different scale of humanity, you see. What was a context as culture just becomes an idea among many ideas which fit into a protean life capacity now. One can subsume a whole millennia of tribal existence under 4 or 5 pages of ideational understanding in the power of the mind. What was a comforting home for millions over 1,000 years now becomes a few flashing ideas which you can master in several weeks. The scale of being human changes, amplifies catastrophically. So here, understanding perceptual paradoxes, writes our author, such as those made possible by masks, is likewise connected with knowing something about the process of personification in its cultural context. In developmental psychology, the significance of processes of personification and their consequence for both individual and social systems of classification are well known, and they are indeed. Vygotsky's famous study of concept formation in children demonstrates not only how the category of the person in use at a given time becomes the basis for the individual's entire system of classifying and understanding, but also how the child, in establishing this category, often admits of and manipulates apparent contradictions and perceptual paradoxes. Insofar as language and culture establish the perimeters of learning experiences, the development of individual perceptual systems cannot be separated from social categories. The notion of how personae function on a metaphysical level, how changes in state or status are affected, is thus the final analysis of a cultural phenomenon. Very well spoken. But there is still confusion here. Well spoken, but not thought completely through to its actual differential limit, where the structure loses the shimmer of the content and becomes the bare relationality of the poignant depth of understanding. There's still a confusion in this paragraph, well written as it is. And the confusion is because one has not understood that protean amplification between a mythic language which explains a ritual action and a magical language which creates the integrated person. Those two languages, though related intimately, are radically different. And not to know that is the very essence of ignorance. I'm talking about the Sanskrit word adharma, non-truth. Not to know that is not to be enlightened. The essence of that distinction, that making that differentiation, centers around in the very experience of understanding symbols. Understanding the interior nuclear mechanics, as it were, or nuclear dynamics is better, of the psyche. And without understanding that, one loses the poignancy here. For instance, in Euripides, the play itself, the Bacchae, as something staged in the theater of Dionysos in Athens, on a stage with actors, with the masks, is still a ritual performed in classical Athens. But within the play itself, within the Bacchae itself, there are cracks all the way through the whole play that show that Euripides has seen through the ritual function. The tapestry of integrity of the whole art form has flexed its muscles and broken the cultural shell that a generation before, two generations before, had not only been adequate, but had been the high watermark of achievement of the whole culture. One generation before Euripides is Sophocles, and two before him is Aeschylus. Aeschylus makes the Greek tragic form. It was an incredible achievement of high consciousness. It was raising the tribal culture of ancient Greece to the point of fine art. But Euripides, with the internalized symbolic conceptual power, shatters the whole art form. There are no great Greek tragedies after Euripides' Bacchae, not one. Why? Because the conceptual form of Greek tragedy was shattered by the Bacchae. The realization was more powerful than the form. The realization went echoing out of the form, like as if Greek tragedy were like a bell of doom that had been struck in the Greek consciousness. And its doom echo went through the whole society and broke it. There are no Odyssean figures, there are no Achilles in Greek culture after Euripides, Bacchae. They stop using Homer as the basis for education. The heroic exploits of Odysseus seem not to be very important in view of the new troubles we have. So that there is a radical change. The culture becomes transformed or put into a transformational chaos by individuals who are larger than the cultural form. You can only have a tribe when the tribe is larger than the individuals. And when you have someone who's larger than the tribe, he bursts the buttons of the tribe. You don't have a tribe anymore. It's like Jesus with Judaism. He just burst the buttons of Judaism. Nothing wrong with Judaism. Nothing wrong with the tradition. It's just that it did its job. It gave birth to individuals who were larger than the tribal forms were able to entertain. Then the same thing has happened now in our time to Christianity. There are individuals who are larger than Christianity because their consciousness, their ability to conceive paradox on a scale that simply outweighs all of the ingenuity that went into the forming of that cultural ethos in the first place. The problem is one of high magic, to put it in a traditional form. Or, if you like the psychological form, it's a problem of psychic energy. It's a problem of being able to integrate more meaning than the cultural forms have allowed for. And so they don't work anymore. Not because they're bad, they're just outclassed by the new scale. There's nothing wrong with the Persian tribe of the Bakhtiari taking their flocks every year in the summer to high ground to feed on the pastures and taking those flocks in the winter back down to the lower ground. There's nothing wrong with that. But if a Bakhtiari goes to a university in Paris and studies modern medicine and he becomes a doctor with modern medicine, he can't go and herd those sheep anymore. And when it gets to be summer, he's not thinking about the high pastures. It's not that they're wrong, it's that that phase is over. It's like a dead romance. That's it. Time to move on. So when man is able to step on the moon, do you think that he can stay behind the fence on the map because on the other side is Canada or Mexico or whatever. It's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. And the kind of consciousness that's happening now is not just stepping on the moon, but it's stepping to the stars. It's a whole different scale, do you see? That the individual becomes protean in a mature way where their individual psychic energy outstrips the capacity of the tribal, of the cultural forms to be of service anymore. And the crisis is not that, oh, well, these forms need to be reinfused with value. That's to miss the paradox of the whole situation. That's to misconceive. And to be fretting and moaning because, oh, well, the religions don't work anymore, and then the societal forms don't work anymore, and the political systems are being ignored by the young. Is to misunderstand the symptoms. Do you think that the butterfly is worried because it's not a caterpillar anymore? Really? And so this transformation that we're dealing with now, the achievement of the person, that person that we are achieving has to have a new quality about them, new maturity. I was going to give you some quotations here from the Philosophy of Literary Form by Kenneth Burke under a section, Magic and Religion. I'll just excerpt it in statement. He's talking about one of Coleridge's favorite statements, that extremes meet. Extremes meet. That what once was a kind of a geometry of ordination, what once was an acceptable self-formation pattern, when it becomes transformed, subject to the powers of transformation and the natural, quote, natural amplification happens, the lines once that were differentiable for you are stretched to the bending point and come round and meet, extremes meet. So that there is a kind of a pretzel involution to what once was a very comfortable diagram. In the 20th century, the diagram of the Newtonian universe was stretched by Einstein's consciousness until the extremities met in a relativity kind of a diagram. It isn't that that is the ultimate truth of the universe. You must understand that that's not so. That's not the importance of it. Its importance is that it is a very accurate expression of the symbol forming amplification, that the Newtonian diagram was stretched to a curved universe. It's symptomatic of the 20th century's transformation and not of the true structure of reality. Don't be too worried that human beings for the next 1,000 years are going to be wondering how to surpass the speed of light. That's no problem. Don't give it a moment's thought. It's not a problem. That's a fretful worry of what they used to call old men's tale. Don't worry about that. That's not anything to worry about. But it is beautifully symbolic in a characteristic way of the way in which a psychological transformation always happens. Einstein, as an individual, outgrew all of the cultural forms, and mathematics, as inherited from Newton, was a cultural form. Where was it from? It was from the late 17th century, early 18th century. It was an Enlightenment age form. And it just didn't fit anymore at all. Believe me, the Einsteinian form will not fit the next generation in the 21st century at all either. There are some already who are just beyond that. It's just simply no longer adequate. The Jungian psychological mode is just its old fashioned. There's nothing wrong with it. And if you get to that horizon and that level, and that's the best you can do, well, it'll comfort you. But if you're hungry for truth and legitimacy, and you can grow, then do so. Do so. And the scale is astronomical beyond that. But the whole problem, and it is a problem, always comes to focus in what you can entertain within. And it's like the old Harry Truman phrase, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And a lot of people excuse themselves. They find nice little rationalizations. Well, I can't make it, or I don't think I can do that. Well, I can't do that now. And there's just an endless litany, and that's all right, too. That's fine. But for those of you who don't give in to those unconscious or subconscious nibblings against your integrity, or those of you angry enough or hungry enough to say, well, wait a minute, I'd like to take a look first before I turn around and go a different way or go back. I'd like a look. What's wrong with a look? If it's all so terrible, well, then I'll cringe. But I'd like a look. That's the kind of courage that Homo sapiens sapiens has. It's that arrow that goes in an eternal motion through time. And no matter what happens, in a temporal phasing mode, that arrow of spiritual integrity, which is eternal, goes right through. Without moving, even. This whole section on art, these two kinds of assignments that you're still working with and the two assignments that you worked with before form a process quaternary of keeping the transformation balanced. Not of giving you a new form, not of you giving you a new ordination for yourself to displace the old one now that's looking a little tired. If you're at all into this, you're beginning to sense that the way I was last year just isn't quite up to snuff anymore. And for those who've been through it for the last year and a half, if you've been really into it, you realize and you think back to yourself at the end of 1986, I don't think I'll go back being that way. I think I'll continue this way, the end of 87. Because you've come through a lot. It isn't that you've been led through. I'm not traditional Hierophant at all. But it's that you've come along to take a look, and you've earned the right to see what's there. That's all. And what's there now is the bringing together of four different processes into a provisional focus, not a new diagram. It certainly is not any kind of a comfortable amulet which you can tuck in your mind or slip into your existential sense of comfortability. It's not that at all. But it certainly is a kind of a template which you can hold up whenever you want to and get an accurate view of what's going on. It's like some of you may remember the great film director Antonioni. And Antonioni used to carry around in his jacket pocket a 35 millimeter slide frame with no slide in it. And almost like a nervous habit, hold that little frame up just to look at everything. Because it wasn't to look at the things, it was to keep the eye in. That when you're working with the camera, that's exactly how much you're going to see. And so you're trying to use what you can see to also show the implications of what you can't see so as to deliver a sense of the real, of the whole. And it was a very Homeric kind of a thing that Antonio, you know, used to do. He used to be able to see the universe in a grain of sand, that kind of a quality. So this meeting of these four projects in the art thing are that kind of a little template which you can carry around with you. Those four processes come together, the poetry, the sculpture, in one kind of a movement, and the mask and the painting in another kind of a movement. And those two movements together are like a choreographer's perspective on what's happening now, what's going on. What in terms of my existential occurrence is happening in this transformational matrix? I'm using high-flown language now because you can listen to the tapes, you can pick this up. That is exactly where we need to be now. We don't need to be someplace there. We need to be, keep on going. Keep that arrow of intentionality still flying and remind ourselves that the really big conception is that this arrow is flying eternally. It's not going to slow down because the bow that I use just doesn't carry the arrow that far. Oh, there are all sorts of lacks of confidence and resistances that come up. Don't worry about that. Just be that arrow of intentionality continuing. The high Mahayana way of expressing this was that the bodhisattva coursing in his nowhereness is always ready to help. And when you see the illustrations, are the bodhisattvas coursing in their nowhereness, are they panicking? Do they have parachutes on? The garments are flowing up with zero gravity, and the elegance of the fingers are up, and they're distributing flowers. Because that's the dimension, the truthful dimension of helping on that scale at that time. Notice that the bodhisattvas are not doing what the Buddha did. They're not just giving insightful ways of differentiating to reveal that there is nothing there. They're where the nothing is. And they're already starting the radiant return back by distributing the flowers and the loving kindness and the compassion and saying, don't worry, just because you think that this compassion is coming from nothingness, from shunyata, that it isn't real. The compassion is totally real. And yes, it has come, made in shunyata. But don't worry about it. Because when you accept it, it becomes real with your acceptance. It isn't real at all until you accept it, but when you do, then it is. And it's just in this way that in the High Mahayana was a very accurate presentation of the way in which wisdom and compassion are not only two sides of the same coin, but that there's no coin at all. There's only the flash of realization that you thought was from a coin in the first place. So that the art section that we have here is the art of person making, but in a very peculiar, radical way. It isn't person making in terms of the tribe, in terms of the culture, in terms of some metaphysical diagram, in terms of some philosophical notion, in terms of some political theory. While all of those are certainly food for thought and certainly elements that can be taken into consideration, none of them are larger than a single thread, a single strand in a very enormous fabric that you're wrapping around you to make your own dress, your own toga, your own cape. None of those is more than any single thread in the fabric. And to try and do a little bit of phantasmal jujitsu with your consciousness to make it fit into one of those threads, you're never going to get the clothing on. It's tantamount to picking lint when you're looking for a new suit. I mean, it's just grossly irrelevant. And it's not worth arguing against. I mean, is this piece of lint more important than that piece of lint? It's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with anything. Ignorance is like that. Ignorance is that condition of not understanding not the truth, but not understanding that this whole sequence and process is irrelevant. It has nothing to do with anything. It is Maya. Maya. It's illusion. Toshi Yoshida did a Japanese print about 1948. He had the Sanskrit word illusion written and put into a Japanese print in bright red, and it was in a sky blue atmosphere, and underneath it was kind of like a horizon as if it were like an earth, and the word illusion was suspended. It didn't touch the earthly horizon anywhere. It was in the sky blue, just suspended there. And Maya is like that. It's like a cloud that's gonna not just evaporate. It just didn't really constellate in the first place. It's not a part of the sky. It's like that. All of those little threads of political theories, metaphysical diagrams, philosophical doctrines, none of that is important. It's only just fiber for nourishment of getting the protein into you in the first place and having it go through your system. It's just fiber in a cereal. It's not even a meal, much less your life. And life is unbelievably real beyond all those considerations. We're trying to deliver ourselves. It's like Socrates said of himself that he's a midwife. Trying to deliver you out of the womb of your ignorance into the life where you can begin to see what's going on. Coming out of the cave into the light. Stopping looking at the shadow. Stopping feeling clever because you can identify so many different shadows. And quick. Wow. Those smoking guns are toys. that kind of gunfighter consciousness is just, it's irrelevant. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. And so we're trying in the art section now, because next week is the last of the art section, we're trying for those who can to wake up. We're trying to bring these project functions together into a focus. And the last one is the mask of a role.